Good morning. I'm Christopher Purdy, delighted to welcome you all to today's edition of All Sides Weekend, where today we talk about the arts and culture in Central Ohio. And as they say on billboards, boy, do I got a show for you. We're going to begin our time together with two mavericks in Central Ohio in the arts. Dave Phillippe is the director of film for the Wexner Center, and Stephen Anderson is the artistic director of CATCO, the Contemporary American Theater Company. I'm just saying that out loud because I can. I remember it, which is an accomplishment.
Done.
Yes.
And yippee-yo-ki-yay.
Yep, yes. And later in this broadcast, we will be joined by Denise Regg, who is the newly appointed executive director of the Columbus Symphony. So we have a lot to talk about. There's always is there ever too much going on for you folks in Central Ohio?
Isn't it exciting?
Yeah.
There's just – you have to make choices. And I remember, I've lived in Columbus for a long time, and it used to be you'd say, oh, good, there's something to do this weekend. And now you literally cannot see everything you'd like to see.
You could be out 4 or 5 days a week and all around the clock weekend. Certainly at the Wexner Center, that's true as well. I want to start with you, Stephen Anderson, because you have a show currently running called Daddy Long Legs, which
right.
has some contemporary
implications.
Yeah, no,
it's you know, we choose things a couple of years in advance, and this is something that we had on our schedule, and it's about a wealthy male benefactor who helps a young woman by giving her college tuition, and it's created some really interesting conversations in terms of patriarchy, and it was written in the early 1900s, and so it's a very old novel that was recently made into a musical, a two-person musical, and it's really very sweet, and it's interesting. Even the reviewers who have said, you know, that they have problems with the issue have said, you know, it's not as icky as it sounds. Well, I don't think it sounds icky at all, but you know, that's the way it goes.
Well, how is it relevant or appropriate in our current Me Too movement?
Well, just in terms of, you know, what are we allowed to give? What are we allowed? There's actually a song in the show called Charity, and it's about who benefits from charity. Is it the giver or the person who gives or who receives? And in fact, it's always an uneasy combination.
What are you hearing from your audiences who go to that show? Are they finding it especially relevant? Are they talking to you about it?
They are finding it, as I did, to be just a lovely little escape. It's a fairy tale. And, you know, I mean, are we going to...
I'm all for it.
Right. You know, I mean, in this climate and in the snow and ice, I just fell into a snowbank today, so I have that on my mind. We're looking for ways to escape, and it's lovely in that way.
This, you know, I think we're forgetting that we're supposed to be entertaining. You know, people go out to be entertained, certainly to be informed, and there's all kinds of room for polemics. But sometimes you just want to hear something and see something lovely,
yeah.
And
these
room
two
for that.
People, Candace Kite and Joe Bishara, have extraordinary voices, and the music is fit to their voices. It's sometimes an artist and a song. And or a score just fit together, and this is one of those experiences.
It runs until when?
It runs one more weekend after this weekend.
And it's at the Rife Center downtown?
It's the Rife Center downtown.
Daddy Long Legs from CATCO. You can go to CATCO.org and find out everything you need to know. We'll be coming back to Stephen Anderson to talk about more of CATCO's offerings and maybe pump you for some future plans to spill the beans. Dave Phillippe, somebody can walk into the Wexner Center and walk out maybe a week later and just spend all that time in a wonderful way with everything that's going on between exhibitions and concerts. And I know the big William Kentridge exhibition is there now, which I've seen and which I'm going back to see again because I'm fascinated by his work. In terms of film, in terms of the visual, people think of film, they think of the Cinemax, but you do that and more.
Yeah, I mean, we have a really diverse, kind of always changing movie schedule. In any given week, we can have a documentary, an experimental film, a classic film, a visiting filmmaker. And this time of year is actually usually a pretty high volume time for us. This weekend, actually. Tonight and Saturday at 7, we're showing a new film called The Insult, which is one of the nominees for Best Foreign Language Film. It's from Lebanon, and it's a really interesting film about this minor disagreement that happens between a Lebanese Christian and then a person from Palestine who's living in Lebanon. And it's like this minor skirmish that becomes this national controversy, and it kind of reveals some of the fissures that exist in Lebanese society. And as I said, it becomes this national controversy, and it's been getting just absolutely rave reviews. And like I said, it's one of the final nominees for best foreign language film. So I think it has a lot of timeliness, and it's really an interesting film.
When you show a film like that that mm-hmm. has political arguments, it will evoke a great deal of emotion from people. And I'm thinking back a few months ago when you were last here, when you were showing James Baldwin's mm-hmm. I Am Not Your Negro. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When the audience leaves, there's going to be a lot of energy in the room leaving, and people will need to do something with that energy, either sometimes anger, sometimes grief, sometimes really exaltation, mm-hmm. and I mm-hmm. think all three. Do you have programs that accommodate that after the films?
Not every film, but that's a really good point. I mean, I was just talking with Stephen out in the lobby. On Tuesday, we showed the documentary Paris is Burning, which it's decades old now at this point. But we worked with an Ohio State professor. If people don't know, it's a documentary about the New York drag scene in the late 80s.
And at the time, that had a huge reach.
It was a very popular documentary.
It really introduced
exactly.
that genre. Yes. Yes.
And focusing on African Americans and Latino performers. And we had this big panel discussion after, kind of exploring some of the themes, black masculinity in queer culture and things like that. Last summer, we showed a documentary called Whose Streets about the riots in Ferguson. And we had a woman named Rhiannon Childs after the film, who's been very active in different political movements in Columbus and beyond. And she came to kind of moderate a conversation after just exactly what you're saying. People – sometimes when you see a film, especially a lot of the films that we end up showing, people are just dying to –
do something.
Yeah, for
something.
A release. They want to say something, or they want to, to talk to someone else about it. And we do try to provide opportunities like that as often as we can.
Something I'm curious about, Stephen Addison, when you program CATCO, you're programming for the live theater with people. And by virtue of the spaces that you use to perform, very often the audience is right, but physically with the actors, which I think is part of the appeal for a lot of people that go to your shows. But you do have sweet, lovely shows and provocative shows and, sometimes a difficult, a thought-provoking show. Film might have even a wider range. So let me ask each of you separately and then together, who are you programming for when you choose what you're going to do in your companies, Stephen, CATCO?
Well, we certainly have a sort of baseline of people that we think of as CATCO people.
Right.
And then so I try to create that kind of a layer first, and then find other things like American Buffalo that was done in American Sign Language and spoken English at the same time to reach a specific community. Fun Home, which was programmed very specifically to appeal to the LGBTQ community. And then other things that we're looking to build audience and people who may not have claimed the theater before as their own. So it's always a mixture in trying to weigh everything out so that it's not balanced one way or another. It's all very sensitive to me right now because we're about to announce our season for next year.
You're not going
to
do it right now, are you?
I'm not going to do it right now.
Okay. That's all right. You'll come
back.
It'll
happen next week. So. Yeah.
And you'll come back, but you're not constrained, but you have to deal with live actors and mm-hmm. you have to get the right person for the right role and things like that. Whereas Dave, you need technical equipment, and that's about all you need to show whatever really you think might be interesting for the community, unless that's unfair.
Well, that's a little
makes
bit.
Makes it sound awfully easy,
yeah,
Dave.
Exactly.
What are you doing with your time?
No, I mean, over the last 5 to 10 years, one of our real new emphasis is to bring in as many directors and people associated with a film as we can. So, that obviously adds a wrinkle that you can't get at other movie theaters usually, or you certainly can't get at home watching on Netflix or on iTunes or something. And What Stephen just – how he described their program is very similar to us. I mean, we have this – you know, general, I'd call it like a cinephile audience that whether we're showing Sleeping Beauty in 70 millimeter or Monkey Business or we're showing, you know, a film like we're showing this weekend, The Insult from Lebanon, they'll, you know, if they're free, they're very likely to come to almost anything that we show. And then after that, it's, you know, again, we might have three completely different audiences in the course of 1 week, you know, and it's really a lot of work to do targeted outreach to different groups that might appreciate that you're showing a certain film or might be invested in a certain issue or something like that. And that's one thing that really distinguishes our approach is we try to give every single film that we show our full attention to make sure people know that we're showing it. And, you know, like a bigger movie theater, if you have, you know, 10 screens or – well, it's just a different enterprise, you know. And we treat each film separately. We try to make sure that anyone that might have an investment in the film or the issue involved in a film or anything that they know about it.
Well, what you do, which you can't really do in the Cineplex that most of us go to for commercial films, what you guys do is every film you show is an event that stands by itself. It really is. It's not just a 10 o'clock show. It's an event, you know, specifically geared to people who really want to see that film.
Right. And we, you know, sometimes, like, again, the film that we're showing tonight, The Insult, in bigger markets, that film is showing theatrically and it's showing multiple times, you know, seven days a week.
Nothing wrong.
And there's nothing wrong with that. But our approach is, and often the distributors that we work with know, if they show a film with us, even if it's only once or twice or sometimes three times, they know that we're going to turn out everybody in Columbus that wants to see that film. Whereas it might, if it played at a multiplex or something, number one, it's not really going to get specialized marketing and, you know, who knows how much business it'll do over the course of 7 days.
And you very often play to big houses, packed houses.
Sometimes. I mean, to be honest, I mean, sometimes we have 20 people in the house. And, you know, my colleagues in the film department, we talk about it all the time. Some of our most fulfilling and rewarding events are films where there's like 30 or 40 people there, but you know everyone that was there. It was transformative. They loved the film.
And they're very committed to that film and being there and to being part of the Wexner's audience.
And that's why we're there. We know some of the things that we do. Only 40 people are going to come. That's why we're there. You know, if it's all about how many people come and how much money you're taking in, we would be making, you know, very different choices.
We're going to take a quick break right now and come back. If you're just joining us, this is All Sides Weekend on 89.7 NPR News. My guests are Stephen Anderson, the artistic director of CATCO, and Dave Phillippe, the director of film for the Wexner Center. I'm Christopher Purdy. Don't go away. We are back. This is All Sides Weekend. I'm Christopher Purdy. Denise Regg, who is the newly appointed executive director of the Columbus Symphony, will be joining me in about 20 minutes. So stay tuned and we'll hear from her and catch up on what the Columbus Symphony has been doing. We have Stephen Anderson here from CATCO and Dave Phillippe, the director of film for the Wexner Center. Stephen Anderson, recently CATCO, I believe in collaboration with CAPA, presented Deaf West's production of Mammoth's American Buffalo, which is a play we can't read on the air. But it's a very powerful, powerful play. I missed this performance, and I'm very sorry I did because I heard tremendous things about it. You had some actors with hearing and without in the production. You used sign language and the spoken word. Tell me about that production and maybe looking toward the future if there'll be other collaborations.
Sure. Well, of course, this isn't my first rodeo in terms of mixing deaf and hearing actors on stage. We did Secret Garden with CAPA a few years ago and did it here and in New Haven. And so Bill Connor, who has now passed, and I kind of cooked up this idea and spoke with the folks at Deaf West, and they were really interested. This was a small production, so it was easier to move here. But it also had some interesting things to say because of the way in which sign language was used or spoken language was used in terms of the power of hearing versus deaf people. That was particularly timely for the 70s when that was an emerging culture. And so the hearing audience literally had headphones in which, if there was only sign language going on the stage, there were actors who were speaking in their ear to translate. And for deaf people, if there was only spoken language happening, there was a sort of reader board, not unlike opera titles. And so it was just a totally immersive experience, unlike anything I'd ever had. If you wanted, as a hearing person who didn't know sign language, wanted to experience what was going on the stage as a deaf person would, you could in fact slide the headphones off of your head, which we saw people doing.
Yeah, because it was beautiful to see. I mean, I don't know if that's a nice thing. I mean it is a nice thing to say, but it was a beautiful thing to watch.
It's incredibly expressive language. Yeah. In the same way that we could say that French is a beautiful and expressive language. And seeing this deaf actor who is just on fire on the stage was really an amazing experience.
Would this kind of collaboration work with just about any play, or was there something specific about Mamet, which is all language?
Yeah, it's Mamet is an unusual choice for a translation ASL and spoken English. But that this particular play and the issues in this particular play, which is about power and shifting power and who has power, it was really a good choice in that way. I would say, you know, I am not a huge Mamet fan, but this particular play was an experience that I've never had in the theater.
You as a producer are always looking for, you always want to be very timely in what you present, even if it's based on a novel that's 100 years old. You go to a Catco show and you are very entertained, and often you're killing yourself laughing, but there's something very relevant all the time in what's going on with the actors, sometimes three feet away from you. Is that really part of your MO?
Yeah, I am a very linear storytelling kind of guy. I will, no matter what happens, I will have a story about it, and it will have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And that would be the kind of thing that we are, in fact, attracted to, or that we typically produce. We certainly look for the adventurous and try to balance it out with the commercially viable. By doing that, we create a kind of hub of theatrical activity that alternative theaters can then work around. And because you can't have an alternative to nothing.
But it has to be also really interesting for the actors and for you, because you know, there's a lot of thought that goes in, a comedy requires a great deal of different kind of concentration to sell.
Yeah. Well, you'll certainly find that with Realistic Joneses, the Will Emo play that is very funny, but also a little terrifying on some level.
It's about the neighbors, right?
Right, yeah. Right, and the identical neighbors in the identical house with the identical name. Interestingly, we've non-traditionally cast this with an African-American couple and a Caucasian couple. So the sameness is an interesting kind of sameness. That's Joe Bishara is directing that. He's a busy guy this year. Starring in
he's a new dad too, Rory.
He's a sleepy
and busy guy, right?
He doesn't have there's not a lot of moss growing on our Joe.
Well, Catco, I will say one thing for both of you. It is impossible to be bored, certainly at the Wexner Center or at Kappa. Dave Filippi, I know you're doing programs really focusing on film restoration, if I'm not mistaken. Can you talk about that? You have things coming up with that.
Sure. In 2 weekends, we'll be doing our fourth annual Cinema Revival, a festival of film restoration, and it runs Thursday, February 22nd through Tuesday, the 27th. And what we try to do is bring in recent restorations in the field and a wide array. Hollywood classics, like you mentioned, Monkey Business earlier.
Cary Grant, Marilyn Monroe.
Howard Hawks directed, yes. Earlier that day, a really beautiful Technicolor CinemaScope film called The Revolt of Mamie Stover with Jane Russell, which I'm really looking forward to seeing on the big screen. But then also
bet you are, Jane Russell.
Requires a big screen.
Yeah, should be 3D or something.
Okay,
yeah.
Anyway,
sorry. And then at the end of the festival on Tuesday night, Barbara Hammer, we're going to be doing a program of new restorations of Barbara Hammer's work, this great trailblazing queer filmmaker who's really just experiencing this wonderful moment in her career right now where she's getting all kinds of attention in the gallery world and film world. And we're going to have guests from the Criterion Collection, 20th Century Fox, Francis Ford Coppola's company, American Zoetrope. Actually, we'll be doing the world premiere of the restoration of his first, I'd call it legitimate feature. He did some maybe naughty films before this one, a film called Dementia 13, a horror film. And anyway, the person that supervises restoration at his company will be there to introduce it. So, again, it's the fourth time that we've done it. And it's such a wide array of films and you're hearing from, you know, the experts. And I think our audiences really love to hear the amount of work and care that goes into, you know, doing these restorations. I think we just take it for granted when we turn on the TV or pop in a Blu-ray or whatever, you know, how much work goes into making a film look like this.
And for cinephiles, and it seems to me that this town at least is filled with them, real cinephiles, to see something that you may have read about or heard about but never seen because it wasn't available to be seen. It's like having Beethoven walk into the room. I mean, it has to be very important to a lot of people or enough people or you wouldn't do it.
Yeah. I mean, it gets more popular every year. And to go back to a film I mentioned earlier, in November, we showed the Disney film Sleeping Beauty. You know, Disney doesn't really let their films out like that very often, and people have it on Blu-ray or whatever. So, you know, everyone's seen it, but we showed it in 70 millimeter, and people were coming up after just, you know, like, you know, I've never seen something
We've
like
never
that
seen
before.
It before.
You know, the color and just the vibrancy of the image, and it was everything from, yeah, that's 70 millimeter number one, but also it's film. You just watch that on film. It wasn't a DCP, it wasn't a Blu-ray. You know, you saw everything that film has to offer. And, you know, this ship has sailed. I mean, we're in a digital world, but sometimes when you can see something on film in a just absolutely spectacular, beautiful print like that, where color is everything, you know, that was one of my favorite experiences recently, where just so many people came up were like, wow, that just looked amazing, you know, and that was very rewarding. Because I'd worked for years to let
that.
Disney,
that was,
yeah,
that that's, was
it's
a hard
my,
thing.
It's my favorite Disney film, and I just always, you know, finally they said yes, so.
What is Venus and Adonis? There's a program you have coming with some restored shorts. That might be an unfair question for you, but I was reading on your website. There's one about Vietnam, I think, that's coming. It's part of, I think, the restoration program. They're shorts that really have never been seen since they were done in somebody's garage.
Sorry. Yes. One of the programs during Cinema Revival is called Saving Orphan Films.
That's it.
Yes. And we did a program like this last year too. And orphan films, in very short, are films that don't really have an identifiable owner. They could be like old corporate films, old educational films, old home movies. You know, there's nobody who has any investment in taking care of this film, whether it's, you know, restoring it or distributing it or whatever. So it's a growing movement. And to the point that there are symposiums and organizations that specialize and are dedicated to saving and preserving orphan films. And Dan Strybel, who's the head of the Orphan Film Symposium, has put together a selection of these types of films, and we'll kind of talk about the field. And I think people always think it sounds really dry and boring, you know, educational films. They're amazing, you know, and it's everything from, you know, unintentionally funny films to ones that just like, you know, the level of dedication that went into making whatever the film is, you know, that people are always entertained.
Sometimes the skill level is very high too. That you forget that there might have been people who became tremendous filmmakers doing it.
Or sometimes people had a company and they were devoted to making educational films and they made the best educational films that they could make. And people have even gone back and tried to do auteur studies of these people that would make whatever. Social hygiene films or other types of educational films. And yeah, it'll be a great program.
Looking forward to that. Here's a question for both of you. How much time do you spend maintaining the core audience?
Well, I think, and from what David said, he's there always too. I'm always at the theater. Always having conversations with our audience, always asking them what they're thinking about, what they've seen. They come to me with lists of things that they've seen in other cities and say, I think this is a great Catco show. So it's not just coming and being spoken to. It's the conversation, and that's what makes it – I mean, if you sit and watch television – you can, as I do, talk to the screen, but there's not a response back. But this is an opportunity to, in fact, have a conversation. There's so few of those opportunities, really, in our digital world.
Well, I would agree with that. And I think there are, a lot of similarities between theater and film in that regard, where, if you think about exhibitions like a gallery exhibition, obviously you want people to come and see it, but there's not like the level of audience interaction that there is, in live theater or in film. I mean, the audience, it's not the same art if you don't have an audience there kind of consuming it. And just like Stephen said, I try to be there as often as I can. I love talking to people before or after a movie. People are not shy about sharing, what you should be doing or, did you see this? Have you heard about this? And I think it's a very big part of the job.
The people who come to the Wexner Center to see films are also surrounded by other aspects of the arts. They're surrounded by the visual arts, by the performing arts. I mean, I don't know if in that building there's over one thing going on. There's usually five or six things going on.
And, when I first started, so I've been there, this will be my 24th year, and it was a real concern when I first started. Like, we tried to avoid having a theater performance the same night as a film, or at least we would talk about it. And now we've just, like Stephen was saying, how the city is exploding with wonderful, whether it's live theater, we have great museums, and you just have to at a certain point realize that sometimes you are going to be doing something that people have to make a choice about. But we love the energy it creates at the Wexner Center, having multiple things going on at the same time.
Less is not more. More is more, and more is better. That's my motto. I want to make sure I mention Educating Rita at Kappa, Speaking of Film. This is based on a film with Michael Caine and
Walters.
And Julie Walters is one of my favorites. This is coming to Catco in a live theatrical event. Can we talk about Educating Rita? Remind people what that is.
Well, Educating Rita is the story of a guy who was a poet who is also a university professor or tutor. And he's pretty much given up his opportunity to be a member of the literati and is sort of drinking his way toward his retirement. And a young woman who's a hairdresser who just can't – it's just not enough for her. And she can't figure out where she fits in the world. And she thinks that the world of arts and letters will, in fact, open the rest of the world to her. And so she it's another one of those benefactor things. It's right. Like who is helping who? She actually, brings him back to life and chooses another life for herself through the education. And at a time when there's a certain kind of anti-intellectualism in this country, I was drawn to this particular play.
Yeah, that's coming up soon.
It's coming up soon, and we'll be welcoming John Putnam back
to
play the lead role.
But meanwhile, Daddy Long Legs is still running, which is – now, you said that's based on a novel that's quite old.
Yes. It was written at the turn of the century.
So are we seeing Top Hats and Tails, or are we seeing a contemporary look?
Certainly, it's not contemporary. It's a period piece and a very sort of nouveau set.
And just a lovely, fun musical with great people in it at Catco. Also, I would be remiss if I didn't remind people all the shows you do for children.
Yes, and Garfield is coming up, and it also is supposed. I have not seen any of the rehearsals, but I understand together, having a great time with it. And we're about to have our big gala next weekend, in which we will announce our coming 18-19 season.
Well, I wish you a very happy gala and lots of fun and continued success. Don't forget, everybody, Daddy Long Legs, The Realistic Joneses, which will creep you out with the neighbors in a great way, and Educating Rita, part of Catco's ongoing season at the Rife Center. Dave Filippi, remind us what's happening this weekend at the Wexner Center and film and anything else you want to talk about?
Great new Oscar nominated film from Lebanon this weekend, The Insult. 2 weeks from now, our fourth annual Film Restoration Festival, Cinema Revival. And just also I'd like to mention this year's Ingmar Bergman's 100th birthday, and we're going to be doing a massive retrospective of his work in July and August, so people should look forward to
that. Are you going to be outside on the plaza again, too, in the summer?
Yes.
Yes? And, that's so much fun.
I think we've settled on our three films. We do one outdoor screening in June, July, and August, weather permitting, and people should look forward to that.
Dave Filippi, Dave Filippi, director of film at the Wexner Center, I thank you very much for coming in. Stephen Anderson, my good friend, who's the artistic director at Catco, thank you for being with us. Denise Regg, the executive director of the Columbus Symphony, will join us in a few moments. Don't go away. This is All Sides Weekend on 89.7 NPR News. From the Second Symphony of Rachmaninoff, which is on the program this weekend with the Columbus Symphony, conducted by Russin Milanov in the Ohio Theater. It is my pleasure to welcome to the program, I believe for the first time, Denise Regg, who is the newly appointed executive director of the Columbus Symphony. Welcome, Denise Regg.
Thank you so much for having me, Christopher.
Now, you're new to the Columbus Symphony. You are hardly new to the arts in Columbus, and you are not. You were with Kappa for a number of years in development. Am I right?
Correct.
So tell me about your journey either across the hall or down the hall to a new office and a whole new outlook, really, of arts administration in this city, probably the most visible platform.
Yes, thanks, Christopher. So, you know, actually my career started in Dayton, where I was the executive director, the president of Culture Works, which was the Arts Fund and Arts Council of the Greater Dayton Region. I came up here to Columbus and became the Vice President of Development for Kappa, which meant I actually was in charge of the development for seven organizations, the symphony being the one that I loved most. So time progressed, and I had put in 5 years doing the seven companies and really had a desire to do something more substantive in terms of depth versus width. And so I had conversations with the board. I had explored opportunities, and I was very, very fortunate that everyone agreed, even including my Kappa leader, that I should become the executive director of the symphony, which I absolutely am delighted to be doing.
When did you take office officially in that job?
Officially, it was October 1. We didn't announce it to the public until mid-October.
So you began as the season was just getting underway with the new series. The season, there really is no season anymore. They don't stop. I mean, there's always something going on.
It seems that way.
I want to make the point that the Columbus Symphony for the last several months has been playing to sold-out houses in the Ohio Theater. They just did a Russian festival that you couldn't get into. Good problem to have.
Terrific.
They did Verdi's opera Aida, also crowded. There's another Russian festival this weekend that will be crowded. People love the repertoire choices that are being made. The community is responding. What goes on behind the scenes to make that happen, to get those choices out there?
Well, of course, it's largely the work of the musical director. He makes the selections. He has help in getting the soloists for the year and the artistic products all lined up. But Rossin is just making great choices. I mean, we cannot recall when a Masterworks concert has sold out. And to step out on the evening of and to hear people shouting above the crowd, If you're in line waiting for Will Call because you have tickets, please stay in line. If you're hoping to get tickets, we're sorry, but we're sold out.
I would have snuck them in myself, but nobody asked me. But I'm just saying, now you have to plan a little bit because there's a huge demand now in parts of the public. And, word has been out for a long time, but now people are being motivated to actually come downtown and buy tickets and go to concerts, which is a wonderful thing. Let's talk a little bit about we are in an era now where a lot of people are listening to music specifically, not where it's being performed. They're listening either streaming, they're listening to live downloads or whatever. I'm of the generation and the opinion that nothing beats being in the hall while it's going on. And I'm starting to see that people are really buying into that. Are you noticing that trend as well? Are you concerned about the electronic media?
Oh, look, having been in this business for a really long time, we've worried about it for so long, you have to ask yourself what the worry is.
Right.
So I think that's what we're really looking at. There is really no replacement for live music. There really is no replacement for live theater, live opera. So, no, I think the more people are interested in music, the better our odds are. And however they decide to do that initially, I think ultimately we are more likely to see them in our halls because of the widespread sort of access people now have to music and to being educated about music.
Last year, the symphony had a double whammy. They lost two key people who really loved the organization and did a great deal for the organization. When Bill Connor, the former CEO of Kappa, and Ann Melvin, the wonderful philanthropist, died within 2 months of one another. Neither death was, sadly to say, a surprise. There'd been illness and old age, et cetera, going on. But clearly a vacuum was created. But then again, you know, not a year after their passing, we're sitting in sold-out houses. And I know two people in heaven who are smiling. But how does one cope with that kind of a loss?
Well, you know, Anne was a very, very special person. I don't need to tell you or your listeners that. She was very connected to WOSU as well.
Yeah, she worked here.
She worked here.
Yes.
And she was a huge advocate. And she was a huge fan of yours as well, Christopher.
Thank you.
Seriously. I mean, she believed you were the best person to do our preludes. So, but that being said, it was a long journey. People's legacies are not so often, so easily put aside, right? Ann had started on a journey with me 2 years before she died about securing financially the future for the symphony. So while we miss her desperately, and the amount of money she left us will not completely replace what she gave us annually, it certainly has provided us with a basis that will continue to support us in the future and will help us as we elevate ourselves and as we find more audience members, more resources. Bill was much the same story, right? The great collaborator. Bill was always looking for what made most sense for the community.
He could have sold ice to the Eskimos. That's the old line,
I
but true.
He probably tried.
And he may still be doing it. That man, he was P.T. Barnum, and he really
was. I used to call him P.T. Barnum all the time.
Did you really?
I did, really. Yeah. So, but I think what you're seeing really is residuals from all of that work, as well as the work of Rossin, as well as the work. I mean, I really have to tell you, the board of the organization has been just phenomenal.
And not forgetting Chad Whittington, whose only job in his whole life has been with Kappa.
Correct.
And who is now the CEO of Kappa. So the organization is in marvelous hands at the very top, certainly. I'm not saying that your job is going to be easy, but I would think that you've got a lot of support in doing what you want to do with the Columbus Symphony and really making sure that they stay at the forefront of our cultural life.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think we are well positioned to do that. I think the relationship with Kappa has been very helpful to the organization.
What is that relationship? Just if you could explain a little bit what that is.
So up until the time I was named executive director, it had been a management contract. Now it is a shared services contract, which is actually very, very important. You know, it is absolutely true that Kappa enables us to get top talent at prices we can afford because we share many of them. I just think that cannot be overlooked. But that being said, I think that we are actually well positioned. We have a great relationship with many, many people in the community. We're working more with groups like Experience Columbus. We're all pulling tighter together around Tom Katzenmeyer over at GCAC. Love that man. Love what he's doing. But I think the arts in general are better poised, and the symphony specifically is better poised than it has been in future years.
Tom Katzenmeyer is another one who could sell anything. He's absolutely brilliant about public outreach and the whole audiovisual campaign they have for the arts in Columbus across the board. Experience Columbus has been, I think, absolutely brilliant. Absolutely wonderful. People think, you know, people who don't are maybe not be regular visitors to your concerts will say, well, you know, it's a bunch of musicians. There's nothing really to see. Why should I go to this when I'm not getting sets and costumes? I'm not getting actors. I'm not getting whatever, yada, 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 yada. What I tell people is you will sit in that theater and the floorboards and the seats will vibrate with the sound. And you really don't know what that is unless you've been there before. If you're watching something on TV or if you're on your phone, which appalls me, but that's how people are doing it right now, or even on the radio, I shouldn't bite the hand that feeds me. But I'm just saying, if you are in a theater, also the Columbus Symphony, I want to make the point is provides acoustic sound. There's no miking going on. It's real sound. And that's rare, as you may know these days.
We've worked very hard to make the Ohio acoustically viable for the symphony.
Right.
Actually, one of the last things Aya did for us was to contribute heavily to that new shell.
Get that shell, right.
Which is acoustically far superior to what we've had in the past. But we took the opportunity to also fix the side displays where we've now got acoustical panels put in there versus the heavy red curtains, sucked up the sound. So we're doing Kappa has actually done many things to actually increase the acoustical sound of the hall, which was, of course, not built as a music hall. It was built as a movie theater.
Right. But again, you can't hear the walls do shake in a wonderful way when they're full crying in a Mahler symphony or an opera or a big Russian piece or something. I want to mention that there's your concert master, Joanna Frankel, the first chair violinist. Mm-hmm. Whenever she comes out to tune the orchestra, it's like a real touch of class just comes across
the
stage.
She's so elegant.
This most elegant, beautiful woman.
She is.
And she's an exquisite artist. She opened the Aida with the prelude, and the whisper of the violins just came out in this perfect line. So you guys know how to set the tone, pardon the pun, before the music even begins.
Well, thank you for that, Christopher. And it's true. We're looking, you know, we happen to have a fabulous and elegant concertmaster. And I'm not sorry she's a woman either, but that aside, we're trying to make everything we do about the whole picture. So, you know, now we did the Russian Winter Festival 1. It did so well, but Postlude was a vodka tasting. And we have the guest performers out, guest artists out there.
Right.
People can mill and mingle and talk and get to know the musicians. We're just looking at the whole package now, not just at what we do necessarily on stage.
Well, what you've done is you've knocked the walls down. I mean, people, you know, also what really, you know, you see pictures of composers and they're very powdered wigs and they're very formal and they are nothing like what they really were. If you ever read their letters, there are letters by Mozart you can't read on the radio 250 years later. You absolutely can't do it. And there's people like that. But one thing that I'm curious about as well is when you invite a guest artist, what time does that person have to really absorb into the community? It seems they are out and about doing master classes and they're doing all kinds of other things. My point is that when someone buys a ticket and goes and sits to the concert in the Ohio Theater, you are seeing about 20% of the time spent that the artists, including the orchestra itself, because they're all teaching and they're all playing in chamber music, et cetera. They're all working all the time.
Christopher, I could not have asked you to have given me a better segue into what I would like to say about the symphony.
I'm real good at this.
Go ahead. Thank you so much. Because, I mean, just take a look at Augustine Hadlick, our soloist this weekend. Yeah. He is doing a masterclass class tomorrow morning with four musicians. Anybody can come. I think it's 11 o'clock tomorrow. Anybody can come. It's wonderful to watch him teach up-and-comer artists. So we do those things. We are musicians, like you're talking in general. Most of them are either giving private lessons or they're working in another quartet or a quintet or whatever it is that they have to do that goes out in the community and provides other services. The symphony creates wonderful, wonderful opportunities for the community outside that hall. And you are correct. So little, in so many ways, It's not about just what happens there. And that's actually a small portion of what happens across the board.
It's a great portion, but it's just part of the story.
Yeah, we have 24 Masterwork concerts, and we've got the 9 picnics and the 6 pops, but we do more than 60 concerts a year.
What I have to love is that last summer, the Beethoven Ninth was done for free outside at the Columbus Commons, got rained out, and by goodness, you tried again the next day, it got rained, but you kept at it. The Columbus Symphony Orchestra and Chorus was going to give that performance for the public outside,
well,
rain or shine, and I salute you for that. I do. That was a wonderful thing.
Well, thank you so much. I'm never going to feel quite the same way about the Ode to Joy.
No.
We got rained out twice.
Yes.
I'm totally rained out. But truthfully, again, we couldn't have done that without Doug Kreidler and George
Columbus
Barrett.
Foundation,
they paid for it. They didn't do it just once. They helped us twice.
Twice.
And both times we got rained out.
And they got wet doing it. But it was a great thing
George
to do.
George was there. Handing out desserts to people.
Here's a little tiny bit of music. I want to talk a bit about our concert this weekend. Go ahead. That's a bit more of the Second Symphony of Rachmaninoff, which you can hear this weekend in the Ohio Theater, conducted by Russin Milanov with the Columbus Symphony. Also a piece that I did not know well that I went and learned and am enthralled by, the First Violin Concerto by Shostakovich, which was written in the 1940s in the Soviet Union at a very, very threatening, difficult time for the composer. And if you want to hear musical irony and bite and passion, then this is a piece for you. These concerts are Friday and Saturday night in the Ohio Theater. Augustin Hedlich, who is a wonderful young violinist, you've had him here before,
yes,
is going to be the soloist, and he's giving... Where's the masterclass tomorrow?
It's 11? Actually in room 1 at the Ohio.
Which is downstairs in the Ohio.
Downstairs.
Just come to the Ohio Theater. They'll direct you, and
correct.
It's free, and I might go to that because I know he's
That'd
very, very, very engaging. So tell me about the future. The Columbus Symphony took some hits over the years, financially and publicity-wise. The audience has certainly gotten over it. There are wonderful, I do want to make the point, there are wonderful key core musicians of that symphony who really have committed their lives to it over the years. And I'm going to forget people, and I do apologize, but I'm thinking of Betsy Sturdivant, bassoon, David Thomas, clarinet, Tom Battenberg, who recently retired, spent his career there at the trumpet. Magnificent people. David Neva's out and about, the violinist, all the time giving chamber music concerts. How's the orchestra now?
I think the orchestra is in a good place. You know, it is. We will keep our veterans. They have been fundamentally important and continue to be fundamentally important. As you can imagine, we are now having some younger people join.
Sure.
Our principal trumpet is young, and I think that things are actually going quite well. I think that people are feeling stronger and healthier and more secure. I mean, I think it's a tough world. I mean, truthfully, the world of being a musician is more disconcerting and difficult than I think people have any idea of.
Why would anyone do it? Sometimes, really, unless you have to. That's the only
Thank
reason.
Thank God somebody does.
I'm just thinking the years of training and work and the rejection all the time for no fault of your own. I mean, it's a rough. So when you come and hear the Columbus Symphony, you're hearing the best of the best. You're hearing
the
Rolls Royces.
Although, you really are.
Yeah. You're also in the Southern Theater. You're going to do a whole, in 2 days, all of 5 of the Beethoven piano concertos.
Correct.
Thank
all
you very much.
Over 2 nights.
Which
yes.
is at the end of this month,
yes.
In the Southern, which is a lovely place to hear music. A really beautiful. It's a beautiful place anyway, but it's a beautiful place to
it
hear music.
It was actually built as a music hall.
Yeah,
so acoustically,
makes a change, doesn't it? Yeah.
Acoustically, it is a great, great venue. And you do feel very close to the musicians there. I mean, it's a great venue.
And very quickly, wrapping up, what do you see as the Columbus Symphony's future?
We expect to have a brighter and brighter future. I mean, we have great aspirations. We're working on strategic planning this year. But we expect to help Columbus make its mark in the United States.
And
we hope to be a part of that.
And you're doing it, and keep on. Here's a little more music. Thank you. I like to give out samples. That's a little bit from the second Symphony of Rachmaninoff, which is being performed tonight and tomorrow at 8 o'clock in the Ohio Theater. Rachmaninoff conducting the Columbus Symphony along with the first violin concerto by Shostakovich. Go to columbussymphony.com more information, for tickets. I look forward to seeing you there. Denise Regg, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
And continued success to you and your journey as the executive director of the Columbus Symphony. I'm Christopher Purdy. This has been All Sides Weekend. Special thanks to our new producer, Kyle McKinnon, who hit it out of the ballpark. Thank you very much, Kyle. Our producer is Michael DeBonis. Our interns are Michael Lee, Alexander Hovacek, and Martin Coleman, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOS News and Public Affairs Director is Mike Thompson. I'm Christopher Purdy. Thank you for joining us here on All Sides Weekend on 89.7 NPR News.